Invitation. I'm definitely not within Epsilon of my PhD, so it's really a thrill to be here. Thank you. So my objective today is to give you a panoramic view of some of the interesting questions that arise in the mathematical study of the Einstein field equations of general relativity, in particular in connection with partial differential equations. So it's a panoramic view. It's not a talk for experts at all, so there will not be any proofs, but I'll try to convey at least some of the concepts. I apologize, I will be using transparencies, but just to give you an idea of where we are and where I hope to get by the end of my talk, maybe I won't, here is an outline. So we'll do a 3-minute course on Einstein field equations and general relativity, just to set the stage. And basically, I would like to talk about three broad general questions. One is the question really of the initial value problem, issues of well-posedness. This is a classical question that goes back to the 1940s, but there have been some spectacular recent developments on this front, and I would like to report some of the results that have been obtained recently in that line of work by people in Princeton and San Diego. There's the issue of the local existence, global existence, and uniqueness, and I would like at least to flash by you the statement of the general nonlinear stability theorem from Minkowski space, which is one of the marvelous achievements of the subject, Kleinerman and Christodoulou, try to explain to you where it's coming from. And then sort of at the other end of the spectrum in initial value problems, I would like to present to you with some theorems which enable you to understand to a certain extent how conditions on initial data can give rise to an evolution which leads to the formation of a black hole and a singularity in space-time. So this concerns the Cauchy problem. These are general existence and uniqueness results. But general relativity is also a field which is rich by the wealth of exact solutions of the field equations. And it turns out that some exact solutions have quite a bit of physical significance, in particular in describing black hole equilibrium states. So I will talk about those results. And also in the realm of boundary value problems, I will talk about some very interesting results on the existence of regular localized solutions when you couple gravity to a non-abelian gauge field. And finally, if there is a bit of time, I would like to talk about a problem that I've been interested in personally, which is the question of the stability of black holes. I mean, I think doing nonlinear stability of black holes is decades away with our current state of knowledge. But linear stability, I think, is within reach, and I would like to present some results on that front as well. So this is the menu for today's talk. Okay, so I've been given a tutorial on how to do this. It's a special case. It was done earlier. I mean, the Kerr black hole has some very, actually, I think this is the one I should aim for. See, oh, okay, yes. How's that? I can, yeah, sort of try to startle you into, how's that? I can focus the upper part, but not the lower part, but I'll just try to shift it back and forth. Yeah, the Kerr black hole has some very interesting features which make the analysis more difficult. We'll get to those in a moment. Okay, so what's general relativity? What are the Einstein field equations? So general relativity is a geometric theory of gravitation. It's also a relativistic theory of gravitation. So geometric means that all coordinate systems are treated on the same footing. So space-time is a differentiable manifold. That's the geometric expression of that. It's a relativistic theory. What does that mean? It means that in that manifold, in the tangent space at each point, what you will recognize is a copy of Minkowski space-time, the space-time of special relativity. And in particular, in the tangent space at each point of this space-time manifold, there is a light cone, a cone of null directions, which determines for you the causal character of curves. Light rays are tangent to the light cone, and causal curves have the tangent vector lying inside the light cone. So there is a notion of future and past for those curves. Well, in curved space-time, straight lines are replaced by geodesics, and the space-time trajectories, the world lines of massive particles, are represented by time-like geodesics. So these are curves that give you critical points of the arc length functional, and a time-like geodesic is a geodesic whose tangent vector lies inside the light cone. So it's either future-pointing or past-pointing, and a null geodesic will be tangent to the light cone. This is the limiting case. So with my signature convention, time-like geodesics have satisfied this sign condition under tangent vectors, and null geodesics, of course, have tangent vectors of zero length. Now, you know, the equivalence principle leads you naturally to view the effect of a gravitational field as manifesting itself in space-time by controlling the way in which a pencil of geodesics in space-time is going to evolve. How neighboring geodesic curves in space-time are going to evolve relative to each other. Well, in flat space, of course, geodesics are straight lines. They remain parallel. In curved space-time, space-time curvature causes geodesics either to focus or to diverge, depending on the sign of the sectional curvature. And there is a famous equation, which I'm writing sort of synthetically in the following form, known as the Jacobi equation, which governs the infinitesimal spacing between neighboring geodesics in curved space-time in terms of the curvature. Oh, sorry, there is no mu. This is u. That's u. That's u. Pardon me, N, yes. Okay, sorry. Okay. Now, so the Einstein field equations, I mean, they're a generalization of the Poisson equation for the gravitational potential. These are equations that Einstein first wrote down in 1915. And basically what they say is that there is a piece of the curvature of the space-time manifold which is directly related to the local distribution of energy or matter in the space-time manifold. Just as you would write Poisson's equation in the form Laplacian of V equals 4 pi rho, something like that. This is a relativistic generalization of Poisson's equation, but it's dynamic. It's a space-time equation. So in the left-hand side, you have a piece of the curvature tensor which has the property that it has zero divergence, because you want to somehow encode into your field equations local conservation of momentum and energy. This has zero divergence as a consequence of the Bianchi identities. And in the right-hand side, well, you have a term which is determined by the sources. It's called the energy-momentum tensor. And whatever field equations you have governing those sources, the energy-momentum tensor is constructed in such a way as to have zero divergence whenever these sources satisfy the field equations. So to be concrete, suppose that you're looking at the coupling of gravity to electromagnetism. So the tensor field that you're going to put in the right-hand side is going to be the energy momentum tensor of a Maxwell field of electromagnetism. So this is something that we more or less should know the expression of from a good undergraduate electromagnetism course. So you have the Einstein equations augmented by the source-free Maxwell equations. This tensor here has zero divergence as a consequence of Maxwell's equations. And in the left-hand side, what you're left with is a piece of the curvature called the Ricci curvature. Okay? You can think of it as a partial trace of the full curvature tensor. Well, this is a very complicated system of equations because it's horribly coupled. And if you want to solve Maxwell's equations, well, you need to know the Levi-Civita connection of the metric. So essentially, you need to know what the metric is. But in order to know what the metric is, you need to know what are the solutions of these equations. So it's extremely coupled. And it's also extremely nonlinear. If you write out what the left-hand side looks like in terms of the components of the metric, well, I've written it this way. I'm going to show you another slide where it's a bit more explicit. So in terms of the metric, this is what Rij looks like. It's a beast. And trying to solve these equations, even to find exact solutions of these equations, is quite an undertaking. Right? So it should come as no surprise that it took quite a while before a good understanding was developed of what the reasonable statement should be for an initial value problem for these equations. I mean, if you're dealing with a physical theory, you want to have some good well-posedness properties for the field equations. Well, this is item one in what I'm going to talk about now. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about some local existence and uniqueness results and a few to give you a glimpse of the global existence and uniqueness results for the Einstein equations as well. Okay. So before I show you any slide, I would like to stress the following point. Now, this is a geometric theory. You're working on a manifold. Coordinates have no intrinsic physical meaning. That's one of the features that makes the initial value problem very hard to formulate and understand, because any time you pick a system of coordinates, well, that system of coordinates may develop some singularities which have no geometric meaning whatsoever. Because you know perfectly well that if you try to cover even a sphere with a single coordinate chart, you're going to run into trouble. Same thing is true in space-time. So you have to think a bit more geometrically, and this is formulated or expressed through the notion of an initial data set. Okay. So I'm going to give you some names and references in a moment. Let me just tell you what an initial data set is and formulate the Cauchy problem in terms of an initial data set. So do you remember this picture that I drew with null geodesics being tangent to light cones? Well, it's not very hard to see, if you analyze the Einstein equations, that these null geodesics behave like characteristic curves for the system of PDEs. So if you're going to set up an initial value problem which would be well posed, you need to give initial data on a hypersurface which is transverse to these null cones at every point. And this is what we're trying to do here. So an initial data set is given by a three-manifold sigma, a Riemannian metric on sigma. The metric should be Riemannian because of this transversality condition to the light cones, and a symmetric two-tensor field, which is going to try very hard to be like a second fundamental form for an immersed submanifold in that big ambient spacetime. Okay? So what you do is that you write down some constraints that connect the metric to the symmetric two-tensor. These constraints are just satisfied on this three-manifold, and there is nothing we're not talking about any ambient space at all for now. But these constraints, so that involve this, the trace of this symmetric two tensor, the scalar curvature of this three-dimensional manifold, and the divergence of that two tensor, these, if these were equations that were pulled back from an ambient space-time, these would be the Gauss-Kodaczy equations. These are the equations that give you the integrability conditions to isometrically immerse a piece of a manifold into a Riemannian space. These equations tell you how the intrinsic geometry and the intrinsic extrinsic geometry of a submanifold immersed in an ambient manifold talk to each other. They're compatibility conditions. Okay? So this is what we call an initial data set. And what is the Cauchy problem? Well, the Cauchy problem is to construct a four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold. This is the Cauchy problem for the vacuum Einstein equation. So in the right-hand side, we have no Tij. Tij is equal to zero, so we just have this equation here. The Cauchy problem is to construct a four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold, an embedding of this three-manifold into the four-dimensional Lorentzian manifold in such a way that the pullback or the restriction of the metric in this ambient manifold under this pullback gives you your original metric in the initial data set. And likewise, the second fundamental form of the immersion pulls back to that 2-0 tensor. Okay? So you're trying to realize the metric and the second fundamental form as being exactly, restricting exactly to G bar and K bar, and you want the Einstein field equations Rij equals 0 to be satisfied everywhere. I mean, conceptually, this is a, this looks like a, doesn't look like a very big step, but actually it is, because it makes the statement of the Cauchy problem totally independent of any choice of coordinates. That's what you want to do. Okay? So let's talk about local existence. I mean, this is a beautiful story that goes back to classical papers of Lichnerowicz, Ivan Chakebrua. It's a long history, but some of the main references are papers by Hughes, Kato, Marsden, Fisher, Marsden, Christodoulou and Kleinerman, and more recently Kleinerman and Rodniansky, so it's 2001. So there are two general approaches that one can articulate to the local existence problem. The first approach is in some sense not very geometric, because it consists in choosing special coordinates in which the Einstein field equations are going to be more manageable. I mean, in the early days of relativity theory, people had been playing with these coordinates, but they didn't have the analytic tools at their disposal to enable them to do a serious analysis of the field equations in these coordinates. But the idea, and again, this is just very, very vague, is to use what are called wave coordinates or harmonic coordinates. So these are coordinates which are defined by, which are such that they satisfy the wave equation, the Lambertian equation in the metric. We don't need to know what those coordinates are. You just feed in that condition into the Einstein field equation. The price that you pay is that this is local. You don't know how far you can extend these coordinates. But the reward for doing this is that the Einstein field equations suddenly become weakly coupled, so that horrible nonlinear coupling I showed you somehow drops down, and you're left with a set of weakly coupled nonlinear wave equations, which I'm writing in this form. So these terms here are quadratic in G and the first derivatives of the metric. Right? So using this formulation, I mean, the best result that we have to date is a recent spectacular result of Kleinerman and Rodniansky, which sort of gives what are, they're not the optimal regularity assumptions, but they're so far the weakest regularity assumptions that one can formulate. So basically you want the metric and the second fundamental form to be in the following Sobolev spaces, so you lose one derivative when you think of the second fundamental form. And here the Sobolev exponent is bounded below by 2. But it has to be strictly greater than true. Then the theorem says that there is a globally hyperbolic development, so there is such an ambient four-dimensional Riemannian space which has beautiful causality properties. So globally hyperbolic is the most, so that it's the optimal causality properties you can imagine. You know, no closed time-like curve, every Cauchy surface is intersected once by a causal curve, it's ideal. And what they prove is that there exists a globally hyperbolic development for which sigma is this initial data surface, and they even have control on the dependence of the metric and the second fundamental form. This is my next theorem. I'll talk about the orders of differentiability in a moment. Local. Exactly. But that's much harder to do. Global means that plus, well, I'll get to that in a moment. It also means that you would like to know if singularities will form or if they will not form. So somehow you need to know how far you can extend the chart. It's not simply a matter of patching. It's also you need to know how far you can go intrinsically. Yes. Sure. Exactly, that's right.
And is there a dimension counting argument that says how many extra conditions, like harmonic coordinates, like
that's right, there is. There is, and it all, and there are no surprises on that front. So things are reduced by the number of equations that you expect to see things reduced by. That's right, exactly. These are the same harmonic coordinates as Choquet-Bruyat. The main advance here is that the Sobolev exponent is lower. The conjecture, but that's, I think, even Kleinerman will admit to the fact that this is a distant conjecture. The conjecture is that the optimal exponent is 3 halves. Okay? Yes. They hope to be able to prove it for s equals 2 for the limiting case, but even that is a very hard conjecture. Absolutely. Exactly. That's 5 halves. Exactly. That's right. Exactly. So you're going from 5 halves down to 2 plus, down to 2, and ultimately, if you believe things down to 3 halves. That's the idea. Okay. Now, you can do things a bit more geometrically, and this was the idea that was exploited by Christodoulou and Kleinerman. So instead of using harmonic coordinates, what you do is that you think more geometrically of this ambient space-time as being foliated by space-like hypersurfaces, which will eventually become level sets of a function. And what you require is that the space-like hypersurfaces be maximal. And this is the Lorentzian version of minimal for a space-like hypersurface. So that they should have, that the trace of the second fundamental form should be 0. Okay. So this is much more intrinsic, and the spirit of the proofs is very different. Let me just flash by you the statement of Christodoulou's theorem and Christodoulou-Kleinerman's theorem. I'm doing this because I would like to sort of give you a sense of the difference of flavor between the two approaches. Okay? In my opinion, this is more geometric. So they take an initial data set like before, and they require that this initial surface be complete as a Riemannian, three-dimensional Riemannian manifold, so all geodesics can be extended indefinitely. and if you're morphic to R3, and there is an important condition that the azoperimetric constant of these three manifolds should be finite. So the azoperimetric constant is the supremum over all surfaces contained in sigma of, you know, the obvious thing, the volume divided by the area of the boundary to the power of 3/2, the area of the surface to the power of 3/2. And then there are some very geometric conditions on the Ricci curvature and the second fundamental form. These are very geometric because they involve global norms that involve the geodesic distance from a fixed point in this initial data set sigma. So basically, you need to have sufficient control over the derivatives of the Ricci tensor, over the Ricci tensor and this symmetric 0-2 tensor. Then you get a stronger theorem. So there is a development. So there is an ambient manifold which has a manifold is C infinity, which admits a foliation by hypersurfaces which are maximal, which have zero, whose second fundamental form has zero trace. These are level sets of a function, and there you even get some quantitative or qualitative results on the dependence of the metric on this parameter which labels the leaves of the foliation. Okay? So C1 dependence for the metric and a continuous dependence for the second fundamental form. Right? Global existence, this is, I think, one of the great triumphs of the subject in quite a few years. This is a theorem that took 500 pages to prove. This is a theorem which is, in some sense, very physical. Let me, before I talk about the statement of the theorem, let me try to explain this to you. We'll see in a moment that if you take initial data sets which contain enough mass in a precise technical sense, then there are theorems due to Christodoulou which say that if the mass of the initial data sets is sort of sufficiently satisfies a certain growth condition, then necessarily a singularity will form, and that singularity will be like the singularity that you would expect in the gravitational collapse of a star. So it will be a singularity that will be hidden by an event horizon. Well, the flip side of this is that, I mean, if this is a good physical theory, Einstein's general relativity is a good physical theory, if you were to take very general initial data sets, so with very little symmetry, but which are in some sense close enough to Minkowski space, to empty space, and now you look at the evolution of this initial data set, well, what you should obtain is a solution which is global, so geodesically complete, without incomplete geodesics. So no singularities should form at all. And you should even, in the best of worlds, have some control on how the curvature will decay at infinity. I mean, this was, you know, I think a dream for many mathematical relativists, and this was finally achieved by Christodoulou and Clannerman. So the measure of smallness of the initial data set, my God, it's given by this quantity here. What are these terms? Well, you see the norm squared of the Ricci tensor. The only term that's a bit exotic is the so-called Bach tensor. So the Bach tensor is a tensor whose vanishing picks out for you conformal Einstein spaces in four dimensions. Right? So that's what this does for you. It's a conformal invariant in four dimensions. And D0 again is the distance, geodesic distance from a fixed point. And basically the theorem says that that there exists an epsilon sufficiently small such that if this J0 is less than epsilon, So if the initial data set is such that J0 is less than epsilon, then there is a unique development of this initial data set, which is geodesically complete. So no singularities will form, i.e. Minkowski space is non-linearly globally stable. All right. Okay, so basically what it means is that there is a foliation that's given by, there is a time function whose level sets are the leaves of the maximal foliation. So you can, it's the same thing as what you had in the local existence theorem of Christodoulou and Kleinermann. It's exactly the same thing. Right? Yes. Your time parameter T can be chosen such that the level sets of T are maximal. It's a zero mean curvature surface, exactly. Space-like. It gives you space-like decay of the data at infinity. So somehow having good space-like, well, good, very subtle space-like decay of the data at infinity, including some there's some conformal information here. The Bach tensor enables you to prove that the null that all the causal geodesics are complete. Time evolution is decay. I didn't write this down, but they made some. They even got some very precise decay estimates on the scalars that you can construct out of the curvature. I mean, I won't get into those, but there are precise decay estimates on those as well. This is called the so-called Peeling theorem. Peeling estimates in curvature. The Riemann curvature. All right. So we've done this. I'll talk about this in a moment. To motivate this, let me go to the black hole uniqueness theorem. So we're going to leave the world of initial value problems, and we're going to think a little bit about boundary value problems, and then we'll go back to the initial value problem. Okay? So all these results that I've quoted up to now are really they have physical significance, but they're essentially of a mathematical nature. But you know, Einstein's general theory of relativity is a physical theory. So you would like to have solutions that describe processes which you would expect to encounter in the universe. Okay? Now, I mean, since you know the work of Oppenheimer, Volkoff, Snyder, etc., I mean, all the realistic models that we have for stars predict that, and Chandrasekhar, that when a star has used up as all its nuclear fuel, gravity will become the dominant force, and it will start collapsing under the effect of gravity. And Chandrasekhar semi-heuristically worked out the limit on the mass of a star, which is such that if the mass, if you have a star whose limit is superior to that mass, eventually it will collapse gravitationally to form what's called a black hole. And this is what I've tried to schematically represent here. So think of the vertical direction as being the direction of time. So these circular horizontal cross sections are supposed to represent the surface of a spherically symmetric star that's collapsing gravitationally. And qualitatively, general relativity makes some very, very precise predictions about how this process should take place. So if the collapse is going to lead to the formation of a black hole, then somewhere along in that process, they will form what's called the closed trap surface. So that's a spatial region in which the curvature is so strong, or the gravitational field is so strong, that all the future pointing null geodesics to points of that surface will be focusing. Right? Gravity has the effect of focusing. These should all be focusing at the boundary. And the famous singularity theorems of Penrose and Hawking say that once, if you've been able to go that far in the collapse process, then by a simple argument based on, you know, Sturm oscillation theorem, basically, what you prove is that there will be incomplete geodesics at some stage in the future. And this is what's sort of represented here. This is the singularity. This is sort of the essential boundary beyond which you can't extend causal geodesics. And Penrose conjectured, this is the so-called cosmic censorship hypothesis, that such a singularity should not be visible from the outside. So it should be surrounded by a hypersurface, which is called an event horizon, which is a boundary that cannot be crossed by causal geodesics once they penetrate that surface. The singularity theorems don't guarantee the formation of this event horizon. I mean, this is something which is really still, in some sense, to be thought of as a conjecture, although it's been proved in at least one special case, which I will get to. All right. It's still a conjecture. Yeah, but this, so the, what they did, they took, I mean, the counterexamples were used to change the hypothesis, basically. So that's the usual game that people play. All right. Yes, in a moment. Okay, so what's the uniqueness theorem? So the uniqueness theorem basically tells you what the, physically you, this will sort of stabilize asymptotically into an equilibrium state. The uniqueness theorem tells you what the equilibrium, asymptotic equilibrium state should be. And this is maybe, I think, prior to Christodoulou-Kleinermann, this was probably the most important global theorem about the Einstein field equations. This is the famous black hole uniqueness theorem. Incidentally, this has a Canadian content because, as you know, Werner Israel is a Canadian mathematical physicist. All right. So here you set, it's really a boundary value problem at infinity. So that's right. The previous theorem also had a Canadian content, it's true. Jerry Marsden being Canadian, of course. Okay. So the uniqueness theorem says that you take a space-time, which is time-orientable, stationary or pseudo-stationary means that you have a killing vector which is time-like at sufficiently large asymptotic distances. Weakly asymptotically simple, technical thing, but it essentially encodes the fact that you're looking at an isolated system. The star is collapsing, it's not interacting with anything else. And the outer region you require to have spherical topology, and the boundary, which is the event horizon, you require to have spherical topology as well. There are good reasons for putting these assumptions on the topology. And then you impose the Einstein-Maxwell equations. And then, amazingly enough, you get the unique solution, which is a known solution that you can write down in closed form, which had been discovered, you know, in the early 60s. This is the so-called Kerr or Kerr-Newman solution of the Einstein field equations. So the theorem says that this outer region has a global chart in which the metric, or the gravitational field, takes the following form. I mean, the precise form is not so important. What's important about this is that you have three parameters, essential parameters, which are identified with the mass of the black hole, the angular momentum per unit mass, and if you're looking at Einstein-Maxwell, the charge of the black hole. So these are defined by mass, charge, and angular momentum are defined, of course, by taking fluxes at infinity. These are not local quantities. Also, there is a condition. I mean, the angular momentum and charge cannot be too large relative to the mass. Otherwise, you won't have an event horizon forming. And in the limiting case in which the angular momentum is zero, you obtain the spherically symmetric Schwarzschild solution of the Einstein equation. So weakly, there's a unique three-parameter family of solutions of the Einstein-Maxwell equations given by this.
And the various conditions are
They are. There is symmetry condition, so a time-like vector, Killing vector, which is time-like at sufficiently large distance. And there is just an axis symmetry condition, so another Killing vector, which has closed orbits and which is space-like. Weakly asymptotically simple, spherical horizon, spherical outer region. So R2 cross S2. Topologically spherical. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. So just two Killing vectors, nothing more.
And this is an improvement over the, I don't know if we did it much earlier, that if you have three Killing vectors, I mean, if you're spherically symmetric, then you're Schwarzschild.
Birkhoff. That's right. Exactly. Exactly. That's right. I'll get to the Birkhoff theorem in a moment, too. Let me tell you why the Kerr metric is sort of a source of interest and also headaches, I guess, when you try to analyze wave equations or when you try to study its stability properties. This is related to the existence of what's called an ergosphere. So you remember when I stated the hypotheses, I required that you should have a Killing vector which is time-like, but all you required is that the Killing vector should be time-like at sufficiently large distances. Well, here you have a Killing vector d by dt, which generates time translations, and because of the fact that the black hole is rotating, because of the presence of angular momentum in the black hole, this Killing vector becomes space-like even when you're still outside the event horizon. So you calculate the norm squared in the Minkowski metric of this Killing vector d by dt, and it becomes negative outside the event horizon. So there is a region in between the event horizon and the boundary of the region where the Killing vector is time-like, where, for example, any energy that you would write, conserved energy that you would write down for a wave equation is going to be negative. Quite problematic. So you will lose positivity properties for a lot of natural conservation laws that you associate to wave equations. In spherical symmetry, this doesn't happen, of course. I mean, in spherical symmetry, these two regions, I mean, these two surfaces are collapsed and they're the same. Okay. All right. Good. Now, so I've given you this uniqueness theorem for the asymptotic state, in other words, the equilibrium configuration. So I have talked about this. Let me go here now. Let's go back to the Cauchy problem for a moment and see if we can understand or formulate a theorem whereby growth conditions on the mass of an initial data set will give rise to this type of dynamical behavior that I presented you with schematically. This type of dynamical behavior. Yeah. So this is, I think, one of the, what can I say? I mean, this is, in my opinion, the work of a genius. And this is, we have to wait for Christodoulou to do this. And I think it's extraordinary work, because, is he coming? No. Yeah, no. I mean, what's absolutely marvelous about these results is that every trick that you see used in these papers is a trick that he had to develop from scratch to get to the conclusion. So he was not, you know, like the rest of us mortals, standing on the shoulders of, generations of mathematicians. He really came up with these techniques largely, on his own. It's extraordinary. Okay. So, what has he done? Well, his theorems deal only with spherically symmetric collapse. Up to now, there are no theorems that are known which give sort of conditions on initial data for axisymmetric collapse. I mean, this is very, very far removed still. Okay. And what he did, so this goes back to Robert's comment, and if you want to have a dynamical collapse, and you're in spherical symmetry, you can't look at pure gravity. Because Birkhoff's theorem tells you that any such gravitational field must be stationary. There would not be any dynamics at all. So you need to couple the gravitational field to an external field, and what he did was to do the simplest possible thing, which was to couple gravity to a massless scalar field. That's a good idea because this equation is conformally invariant, so you can use the conformal structure of the problem to somewhat simplify the analysis. So you write down the most general spherically symmetric metric, so, and you use null coordinates. So the level sets of the function, so all the metric functions depend on U and R, and the level sets of U are null geodesic cones. So they're future pointing null geodesic cones. And the earliest collapse theorem, which has been improved subsequently by Christodoulou, but I'll state this one because it's the one that's the least difficult to grasp, is the following. So he gives initial data on the future pointing null geodesic cone at U equals zero, so at the center of symmetry. And so this cone has space-like cross-sections, which are two spheres, and the mass of an initial data set is given by a function, m of r, the mass, which will depend on the area or of this cross-section. Yes. So this is the ADM mass. This is mass is not a local quantity in general relativity. It's an asymptotic integral. But if the geometry is spherically symmetric, you can integrate out the integral and you're left with a function. That's what it is. That's right, exactly. And basically, it's a growth condition on the mass. So the mass has to grow sufficiently fast relative to the area of the cross-section. And you can, it's very quantitative. So this is the growth condition on the mass. So if the mass grows sufficiently fast, then a trapped region is going to form in the future, and you will have non-geodesic incompleteness. Not only that, you even get control on the rate at which the curvature blows up as you approach the singularity. So for example, this algebraic norm square of the curvature blows up as at least as far as 1 over r to the 6th. Sorry. Okay. So it's quantitative. Yes.
R is going to 0.
R is going to 0 at the singularity, exactly. Okay.
R, you're looking at a sphere area.
4 pi r squared. Exactly, the curvature blows up as fast as that. That's right. No, not at all. Not at all. Okay, so I've done this. I don't have much time left, do I? So I've maybe a couple of minutes left. Excuse me. Oh, my goodness. I don't know the answer to your question because, it's not the three-dimensional curvature which gives you information about the geodesic incompleteness. It's the four-dimensional one. So I don't know the answer to your question. Okay. Let me, let's see. Let's forget about this. This is the stuff I've been interested in, but I'll just won't talk about that. Let me quickly conclude with some remarks about the existence of localized solutions, which are regular. Okay. So remember, when you couple gravity to electromagnetism and You look at solutions which are asymptotically flat at infinity, which have this event horizon, then what you obtain is a solution which has a singularity, which is the Kerr-Newman black hole. Well, Maxwell's equations are particular instance of the Yang-Mills equation, in which the gauge group is abelian, so these are linear equations. And a natural question that people were wondering about was to see whether coupling gravity to a non-abelian gauge field, so coupling gravity to the SU2 Yang-Mills equations, could give rise to solutions which are regular and localized. Because, you know, the Yang-Mills force of the Yang-Mills interaction has a repulsive effect, gravity has an attractive effect. Somehow they could maybe compensate each other in a stable way. So the first work on this was done numerically by Bartnik and McKinnon, and they came up with a family of solutions of the Einstein-Yang-Mills equations with spherical symmetry, which are localized and regular. But these solutions were unfortunately unstable. So from a physical point of view, they're not really very realistic. The existence of stable solutions was done by Smaller, Wasserman, and Yao. So they looked at the spherically symmetric Einstein-Yang-Mills equations. So Ricci tensor is equal to the energy-momentum tensor of the Yang-Mills field. And what they did was that they proved that the Einstein-Yang-Mills equations that need global, regular, spherically symmetric, and static solutions. So regular means that they're diffeomorphic to R4 as manifolds, so all the geodesics are complete. And they even have decay conditions on the curvature at infinity, from which you can conclude that these are really localized solutions. The techniques there are not PDE techniques, they're ODE techniques, but they're extraordinarily complicated. I mean, because these are nonlinear equations, you have a global boundary value problem, and none of the existing machines works by itself. You really need to sit down and sort of start digging the trenches and need to go quite deep, actually, before it works. Okay, I think maybe a last comment. So there is the issue of stability, which I haven't talked about. We know that Minkowski space is globally nonlinearly stable. This is Christodoulou and Kleinermann. Very natural question that you can ask is whether a black hole, so a singular solution, should be stable under perturbations. And it's very physical. Imagine that there are incoming gravitational or electromagnetic or spinner waves coming by. Well, how is this radiation going to interact with the gravitational field of the black hole? Will the event horizon disappear? It's going to come back. Well, the linear stability theory has been around now for many years. In the spherically symmetric case, it goes back to Radje and Wheeler in the 50s, I guess. In the axisymmetric case, this is work. I mean, but it took much longer to even formulate the problem correctly. The first investigations go back to the 1970s with the work of Tucholsky and Price. And this was largely numerical work. And numerics showed or indicated that by all accounts, black holes, the Kerr-Newman black hole or Kerr black hole, rotating black holes should be stable under even gravitational perturbations. But there is no rigorous proof yet for the gravitational perturbations case. My collaborators, Finster, Smaller, Yao, and I have just, well, we did the Dirac case a couple of years ago. We've just finished the case of scalar waves. Royal pain is that you need to deal with this conserved energy which changes sign when you enter the ergosphere. and that's the source of a lot of misery. But somehow this can be controlled. The gravitational case, well, there is a conserved energy, but it involves, you know, fifth derivatives, I think, of the Weyl curvature, and we still don't know how to massage it. But I believe that the result is true. Nonlinear stability should be true, but you know, I think it's still quite distant. Even for Schwarzschild, oh yes. I think this is still, I mean, people have been doing nonlinear stability just of the sitter. So basically, you know, you just take, instead of taking zero sectional curvature, you take constant sectional curvature, and this is already an incredibly complicated problem. In Schwarzschild, full nonlinear stability is still quite far away. But I know that, for example, Rotnyansky and Lindblad are quite interested in that. So, I mean, these are very, very smart people, and they could very well do it. But we never know. Okay, thank you.